Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Thursday, January 12th, 2017. Earlier today, this happened. C-SPAN's coverage of the House of Representatives was switched to a live feed of Russia Today's television channel. It's true. Probably makes sense to just cut out the middleman, go right to the source of the news. Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about... but we'll talk about other things as well, such as California Governor Jerry Brown's new budget, George Lucas's new museum, weather politics, and, of course, other political news, and we'll wrap up with our news quiz. I always like to note, we are a place for folks of all views, so any opinions that are expressed up here today are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there with Bob Butler. Bob's a reporter for KCBS Radio. He's on Twitter at BobButler7. Next to him is Chuck Nevious. Yes, he's retired, folks, but he's back. Former columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, but you can still read his thoughts by following him on Twitter at CWNevious. And next to me is Carson Bruno, the Assistant Dean for Admission and Program Relations at Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy. He's also the author of the California Real Politics newsletter, and he's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. There are question cards throughout the room. I think you all know the drill. Submit questions, and I will try to ask as many as I can during this hour. On to our roundtable. So next week, Donald Trump becomes president. Comedian Samantha Bee says he'll immediately start tearing down his predecessor's legacy just as if it was a bankrupt Trump hotel. He's already set to enter office under a cloud of distrust, and right now it's on kind of two big things, his business dealings and Russia. How many of you watched his press conference this week? Quite a few.
It's an informed crowd right here.
How many of you were impressed?
Bob, let's start with you. How do you think he handled those two big issues in this press conference, his first conference since the election?
Well, I don't think he handled either issue at all, much less well. I mean, he, I think, still insists, even though he admits that Russia was involved in some hacking before the election, he still doesn't think it's a big deal. I think that's a big problem. And then he brought his lawyer in to explain how ethical he is and not to worry about him keeping his businesses. He says he'll have his sons run them. I mean, this is uncharted territory for us, and I'm not sure where we go from here. Mm-hmm.
Chuck, when he got into... Did you watch the thing?
I did.
When he got into a verbal confrontation with a CNN reporter, they both were trying to talk over each other, when he refused to answer a BBC reporter's question, I mean, I was watching some of this, and I was thinking, this is where Richard Nixon ended up. This is where Donald Trump is actually starting.
As
a reporter, what was your reaction?
Well, the one thing I would say is there's always time to panic. We don't have to panic yet, okay? There's always time to panic. And I think this may be a little bit of a contrary. He's obviously a divisive, I would say terrible person who bullies people and so forth. But at this point, he's engaged in sort of magical thinking. If I say it, it's going to happen. If I say Mexico will pay for the wall, it's going to happen. And Mexico, of course, had a press conference today and said, no, we're not paying for the wall. What are you talking about? You know, at some point, he is going to take office. He's going to have to make decisions. And he's going to make decisions that will have real repercussions. Not tweets, but real repercussions. And at that point, I think the rubber's going to hit the road. Even with his confirmation hearings, we're seeing it's not as easy as he thought it was going to be. And this idea of that's enough, you won't be able to, you can't export your goods, you can't build another country, we're going to hit you with terror. Well, there's a lot to do for that. This Obamacare thing, I can't remember who it was that said it, but he said the Republicans are a little like the dog who caught the bus. Okay, now we got it, what are we going to do here? It's not going to be as simple as he's made it seem. And I'm waiting to see our democracy rise up and actually have an effect. I don't think he's going to get to do as much as he wants, and I think the reaction, his reaction, will be telling and may very well change a lot of people's perception of him.
Carson, you're a Republican who has been critical of Donald Trump. Has what's happened since the election made you feel you're spot on or made you more optimistic or more pessimistic? I mean, what's your reaction been?
I've kind of stopped reading the tweets because that makes me feel sad inside. There's a lot going on here, obviously. It's a lot of the theatrics of Donald Trump that he's been engaged in since the beginning of this campaign. And let me go on record to say I was absolutely wrong about him from the beginning of this campaign.
You're the only one.
But, you know, and it's proven to be successful thus far. Now, can those theatrics move from the campaign into governing? We will find out in short order whether that's the case or not. Campaigns, as difficult as they are, especially national campaigns, are the easy part. I mean, I think President Obama realized this post-2008, going into then, what was his actually having to govern, having to do things, then being hit by 2010, and really kind of his grand agenda being, you know, screeched into a halt. Will we see something similar to that? Most likely, yes, for the Trump agenda. What it kind of looks like remains to be seen. Is it a backlash from conservatives within the Republican Party who realize, oh, wait a minute, we didn't actually elect one of our own. We don't really know who this guy is. Or is it coming from Democrats? Is it coming from the people who elected him, who thought they're going to be getting all of these things he promised, and then he can't deliver on those promises? So it's hard to say, and I feel like after this election, I'm going to be a little bit more cautious in kind of my punditry and predictions, because it's proven that politics is a crazy business to be in.
Carson, your prediction, who will be the Republican Democratic nominee in 2020?
You can see who's trying to start to angle toward 2020 already with what's happening in this confirmation hearings. I mean, the fact that Cory Booker testified against one of his colleagues in the Senate.
Marco Rubio stepping up against Wilkerson.
Elizabeth Warren is really making a big play at it. Christine Gillibrand, this New York senator. So you we'll be able to get clues about what kind of is on the horizon. Yeah. Whether again it is that kind of that. Confrontation from within the party, but then also from the Democrats.
Bob, what is the likelihood that the first major blow up, again, every president gets into it, the big roadblock or that something that throws them off their stride, that they maybe either surmount and do well with or it really kind of hurts them? How likely is it to come from Russia? And I'm getting to the story that came out this week. CNN was reporting about, the Russians, those were
close.
The days, that there was this dossier of dirt on Donald Trump that the Russians had, and BuzzFeed, I guess, published it, and this, in fact, became a point of heated contention within in the debate. But how likely is it that perhaps this first big hurdle or whatever he gets to is going to not come from the Republicans or Democrats, perhaps, but from totally external?
Well, I think the Russia issue, contrary to what he has been saying, that why didn't they bring this up before the election? I recall hearing Hillary Clinton mention this numerous times about this issue with Russia, and why wasn't there more said about that. I also find it very interesting that the FBI had this dossier, months before the election, and then chose not to do anything with it, chose not to even mention it, which makes you wonder why they mentioned the emails and not this dossier on somebody who may well be, damaged goods. So I don't know whether he doesn't really care, and I don't know what's going to happen, because Once he becomes the president, he's going to control the House, he's going to control the Senate, the Justice Department, and possibly the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So where do you go for redress if there is an issue? I mean, and it's proven that many of his supporters don't care, even if the media reports on it, because they think that the media is talking, you know, reporting fake news, which is ironic because I think the epitome of fake news is how he got to where he is today, which is the birther movement.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember that the Republican, they do have a majority, but they have a narrow majority. And previously, they had a narrow minority, and they were able to really put a lot of wrenches in the works. I think history is littered with presidents who come in with an agenda, who have an idea of what they say they're going to do, and they end up getting blindsided by another factor. You think of George W. Bush, he had lots of good ideas, but it turned out to be weapons of mass destruction. You think of LBJ, I mean, he took this courageous stand, the Civil Rights Act, Vietnam was his Waterloo. You don't control events, and those events are going to be what define you. And at some point, something like that is going to happen in the Trump presidency, and he's going to have to handle it. And that's where his legacy will be written, I think.
The Russia story is very concerning. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't sugarcoat it any way possible. I mean, you have a president-elect who is believing Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks organization more so than
and Putin.
His intelligence network, who, while they're not infallible, I must say, are some of the best intelligence officers in the entire world, if not in human history. Mossad might be a contender there as well, but I mean, these are hardworking patriots. So that in and of itself is concerning. Mm-hmm. But then you obviously have clear evidence that there was Russia state sponsorship of some sort of covert actions within our electoral system. And that is concerning of itself. And I certainly hope the Republicans, who have been, you know, very, I wouldn't say maybe anti-Russia, but Russia hawks for probably the last, you know, I think about a century or so, that they don't abdicate that now just because it might be politically dissatisfying to their president.
And I think you saw it with Marco Rubio taking a very hard stand on Wilkerson, the potential Secretary of State. Would you call Putin a war criminal? Well, I don't know. He really pressed him.
Right.
Wilkerson came back the next day and suddenly was much more in favor of sanctions, and now he's not sure that Obama went far enough with the sanctions, and we really have to go with these sanctions. And, you know, this is a moving target. And you can see where Trump is coming from. I mean, our assumption is we're using Trump goggles. Is this good for me or bad for me? Well, any of this Russian stuff is bad for me. Therefore, I'm going to tamp it down as much as possible. But there is an avalanche of information that's coming out, and it may only get worse, and at that point, he's going to have to confront it. The other thing I think is he tweets 140 characters, and we write 140,000. You know, I mean, we, in our own way, formally, I'm retired, so I can't say we, but...
Wait a minute.
In a way, the media is enabling him by taking all these tweets so incredibly seriously. Now, it is important to look into his business dealings. It is important to look into his foundation. Those are hard news stories. But just because he popped off at 3 in the morning doesn't mean it has to begin the news cycle every single day. And I think we have to get over that.
I have to disagree with you on one thing.
That's unacceptable. You can't.
You said in a way the media is propping him up. It's not even in a way. If it wasn't for the media, the mainstream media, the cable media, everybody, you would not have a President Trump, I don't believe.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there's this no precedent for giving a political candidate as much free press as he got during this campaign. Mm-hmm. And I believe if you would have covered the rallies a couple of minutes in, see what he has to say, and then get out, you wouldn't have had the specter of him being this big bully. But people love that. Because they want to see what they think is a strong president. They don't understand that, you know, how many of y'all had a bully in school? Were they the strongest person in school? No. You know, and it's that quiet person that you had to worry about because the bully picked on him and got his butt kicked. So I think it's really a problem of what the media has done. I know that some media executives really felt like even though he may not be good for the country, he was great for business. So we're going to keep him on the air. And then election night, they're all sitting there saying, oh, my God, how did he win? Well, that's how he won.
Someone in the audience asks, and I'm going to answer this question with another question from the audience. And they ask, wouldn't this discussion be more interesting if someone actually liked Trump? Well, here's part of the problem. So many conservatives don't like Trump. We've got P.J. O'Rourke coming up at the Commonwealth Club in a month or two. He calls Donald Trump the landlord of the flies. We've had a lot of folks, and we certainly will have folks who are in favor of Trump as well, but it can be hard to find some. And so this other question that I want to kind of segue into then is, because it cites another conservative critic of his, given Trump's record, what probability would panelists assign to his forced resignation or impeachment within 12 months as advanced by David Brooks and others in academia? So.
Well, I think there has to be an event. There has to be something that pushes that agenda. But given his behavior so far, I mean, it's entirely possible that he will double down. Whatever happens, if there's some kind of a extremely difficult catastrophe kind of a thing, he may double down. And I would also say that it seems to me that a lot of the people that supported him are the same group of people that have deep suspicions about what used to be the Soviet Union, what used to be Russia. And I can't believe that they're comfortable with this stuff coming out and him saying, it's an asset that I have a good relationship with Putin. That's a great thing. I'm not sure that that's playing well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were theories out there that Pence, you know, is well-liked amongst congressional Republicans and the larger Republican establishment.
And he served in the House for a while, right?
Served in the House, I mean, you know, governor for a period of time. So, I mean, he is part of the establishment for everything it's worth. So there were theories out there that, yeah, maybe they would try to do something to impeach or try to force a resignation so that they get a President Pence out of the deal. That's kind of like House of Cards sort of stuff that politicians are, at their very instinct, very risk-averse people. I mean, that's how you get to Washington, D.C. You don't take risks because that could trip you up somewhere along your line to getting to Congress and to the Senate.
Plus, especially for the very conservative Republicans, they're kind of getting a lot of their long-term dreams.
If Trump ends up being the kind of chairman of the board sort of deal that he has said in private and sometimes in public, then there's a lot of upside for a lot of people in D.C. And you're already seeing it with the people he's nominating for a lot of the cabinet posts and then also and on downward into some of the more, you know, the non-flashy, newsworthy posts. These are insiders, really. He's not draining the swamp.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Anyone who thought he was fooling themselves.
Right. Bob?
I'm not going to take that bet because, I mean, nobody would have expected him to be where he is today. I look at the number of people. He had 11 opponents that he vanquished. They all talked about him like a dog, and now they're, you know, carrying his baggage for him. So I think Congress will be the same way. And, you know, you said that nobody left here likes Trump. I don't know the man, never met the man. I don't know anything about him aside what I've read and what I've learned. So I can't say I don't like him. I don't like what he stands for. I don't like what he says he wants to make America great again and take it back to when it was great. And that's not too good for me as a person of color. Okay. So, but I would not be at all surprised to see him serve his entire 4-year term. I don't see him getting reelected. But I wouldn't be surprised if he serves his whole term.
If he can be that guy, I mean, nothing is easier to maintain than a bad reputation. You know, if he can be that guy that, oh my God, he's popping off again. He's saying this. He said, you know, the stock market liked this. You know, the stock market thought this could be good for business. If he could be this sort of voice in the wilderness and he's sending out these tweets and saying all kinds of things, but in the meantime, business finds it to, he could easily last it out. That could happen. Again, if there's a crisis and he has to deal with it, that's when we're going to see who Donald Trump is.
Well, let's talk about the folks he's nominated to serve in his cabinet and as well as some non-cabinet positions. Bob, as a journalist, what do you think about the fast-tracking of these positions, because a lot of them these folks have not been vetted fully or much
not,
at all.
Haven't been vetted. We haven't seen their tax returns, which we probably never will now. We don't know what kind of ethical challenges they may have. I mean, you know, in reading up on some of these folks, you look at some of the controversy surrounding them, and there are serious problems there. I mean, look at your Secretary of State, you know, who ran a company that helped fund an organization called ALEC, which is an organization which basically writes laws around the country, you know, that, you know, are favorable to things that Californians aren't favorable, don't like, such mm-hmm. as, you know, they're against climate change, anti-climate change, things like that. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I think are really problematic with Secretary of State. I was frankly, you know, gratified with Mattis, the defense secretary, who basically, when asked about Russia, he came down. He basically broke with Trump on a lot of different things, and I'm thinking that the president-elect may have bit off more than he can chew by putting some of these folks in there, because they don't agree with him, and they will tell him they don't agree with him. I'm not sure how he's going to handle that.
They certainly. He's got some very strong folks in there. I want to go to you because Mattis was a former colleague of yours at Hoover,
yes.
Am I right?
Yeah. Mattis's nomination was the only thing that really gave me hope about the next 4 years. General Jim Mattis is the definition of an inquisitive scholar, a patriot in every sense of the word. He's smart.
He's smart.
He's curious. He thinks before he speaks always, and he wants to make sure that he knows all the facts before he speaks. And so he's the one to watch. If you start to see him getting, he's vocal. He'll tell it like it is. And if he starts telling it a little bit too much like it is, or abruptly resigns, then something's happening in behind closed doors. But he will be the only one to really keep, you know, the state of ship, you know, kind of on course, especially when it comes to foreign policy and national security.
After 40 years in the Corps, he takes no prisoners. He's no fool.
Yeah.
Now he needs to get a waiver from both houses of Congress. It's a law, right? It's not
six
just
years.
Tradition.
Yeah,
you have
seven,
to be
7 years.
Seven
think.
Years.
Yeah,
if you're he would have to be out of the military for 7 years before he could serve as Secretary of State.
Can't have served in active duty. You know, and maybe I'm just a wild-eyed optimist, but this is bigger than one person, and this process is bigger. And as I said, we're already seeing people starting to triangulate their position. And to see Marco Rubio take Wilkerson on in a big way, it's not a lockstep monolith kind of a thing. There's a lot going on here. And, you know, we heard Trump, we're going to lock up Hillary Clinton. Well, no, we're not going to do that. You know, we're going to get Obamacare going right away. Well, wait a minute, let's don't go too fast. The ethics thing. I mean, I think he's very seat of the pants, but there are a lot of factors. And we haven't completely turned the country over to him. We've elected him president.
Someone in the audience asks, do you anticipate congressional rejection of any of his nominees?
No,
probably. Yeah. I'm more troubled by Sessions than anybody. I just feel like he's the guy that was kind of a thumb in the eye. And it was interesting that the very first thing he did was to say, "I'm not the person that you think I am." Those, you know, he was extremely aware of all that. He wanted to make that kind of impression. But that's the guy that, you know, to me, is like, you're going to make him attorney. I don't see that. But some of these other people, as you said, I don't think some of them have been terrible.
I mean,
I think they're going to have to respond to the will of the people too.
Obviously, if you are progressive or a liberal, you're not going to like their policies or you know their ideas. But at the face of the issue, I mean, they are for the most part decent managers, and that's what you want for someone who's overseeing a bureaucracy. And they, for better or worse, most of them kind of know the subject matter.
Elaine Chao used to be deputy transportation secretary.
I mean, that's Betsy DeVos. Yeah, she is for charter schools. So if you're not for charter schools, then you're not going to like her. But she is a very accomplished individual and knows education policy. Obviously, Mattis knows the Pentagon very well. You know, the one big kind of what was Ben Carson in HUD. Again, Ben Carson, a very accomplished surgeon, may have made more sense kind of in CDC or in the Surgeon General, maybe HHS, but even so, I mean, that's a tough thing for, I think, him to even handle. But that was kind of like the one kind of what was going on there.
he nominated a woman. He nominated a person of color. He's not unaware of the fact that he has to appeal to a wider range. This is the greatest country on earth. You can't tell me that he doesn't go in that office and take a moment and look around and think, holy crap, you know, this is a big deal. I better not screw this up. You can't just toss stuff off the top of your head. You're going to have to lead this country or appear to lead this country. And I think it's going to be a shock to his system.
I think he's already admitted that. Even after he met with Obama, he came out of that meeting and said, I didn't realize all this entailed.
Right. Right.
You know, the thing about it, though, when you have all of the appointees, they're not politicians. And that rubs both ways, okay? They're good managers. Mm-hmm. They can manage the departments. But can they get things done in Washington? Because for every policy they want to put in place, a lot of it needs congressional approval.
Yeah.
And even though you may have a majority, like in the Senate, it's only a couple, two or three, you have a larger majority in the House, and that's where the money is. But you have a lot of Republicans that, you know, I think held their noses and are supporting
this
administration.
If it starts to go the other direction, you could see them jumping ship in a hurry.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, the one thing to remember is, yes, he gets to a point, I think it's something like around 5,000 appointees, but that's a drop in the bucket when it comes to the federal government civil service. So, yeah, so these people are being appointed to the cabinet positions, the cabinet positions, the deputies and whatnot, but they're going to have to deal with a large number of civil servants who, in many cases, and more so every year, have been there for decades.
They're entrenched,
And so
institutional memory. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. So, you mean, they're going to have to battle against kind of what has been done, the political persuasions of those individuals, who, in most cases, probably won't be the same as the president, Congress, or the cabinet secretary. But, so, I mean, even we have this system of checks and balances within kind of the Congress, White House, courts, but you also have checks within the bureaucracy itself, just given the way that our civil service is set up.
And there are some positions that are more nebulous, perhaps bureaucratically speaking. Rudy Giuliani is going to be an advisor on cyber issues. I assume lesson one is stop tweeting. But RFK Jr., Kennedy, who's going to be heading up a commission looking into vaccine safety. He is a harsh critic of vaccines and vaccine companies in particular. I would think maybe because we might, if you're looking for kind of some fun news that's, you know, entertaining and sad or exciting or whatever, it might be from some of these folks who don't have the bureaucracy around them, both helping to shape them and filling out their jobs, but have more positions where they can kind of say more incendiary things, perhaps.
I don't think it'll matter to those people that support the president-elect because. I mean, all the things that happened during the campaign didn't matter to them. They still wanted to vote for him. So you can have a bunch of, you know, crash and burns of people he appoints, and I don't think it'll make a difference.
And I promise this will be the last time I bring this up, but I actually have met Donald Trump because I met him on the golf course. He was playing at the AT&T golf tournament, and he had a hole-in-one. And I went out and interviewed him and wrote a column about it. And he can be charming. And the only thing I'd say about that is people who try to be charming want to be liked. They like being liked. And he's facing some really it's no fun to be the man in the arena. And I think he's already fudged on a lot of these things. This is really unpopular. I'm getting a lot of heat on this. So I'm not appointing a federal prosecutor. I just said that. You know, that was just one of the things I said. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him try to be. I think he has this sense that he's going to be win people over. And to do that, he's going to have to change some opinions, I think.
It'll be interesting to kind of do our one-year-in review.
Yes, it will.
someone asks, and I hadn't heard about this, but what do you make of Trump firing the current heads of the U.S. nuclear arsenal program with no indication of who will be placed in those positions? Had you heard anything about that?
I didn't know that.
We're not going to be able to help you with that one. Sorry.
When did this happen?
I don't know. I had heard he had, you know, they were announcing all the
ambassadors
are going out. Yeah. Which they would have done sooner or later anyway, right?
And, don't be too surprised by that. Again,
that happens every
year. It happens every year. And also, again, there's deputies. And I mean, there's
The ambassadors are usually
whole infrastructure is there. So. I mean, so it's not like all of a sudden we have no one in these countries kind of representing our needs.
Who's going to tell us what's going on? Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that.
I think that was mine, John.
Well, let's actually move along to some California stuff. Now, California Governor Jerry Brown unveiled the state's budget this week. It has a projected $1.6 billion deficit. So are we headed back into the days of deficits? I mean, we certainly have seen bigger ones. Carson, do you want to start with that? What do you think of what we know about this budget so far?
And what it means? What we know about the budget is, again, this is the first stab at the budget. So the legislature gets to look at it. They get to start the negotiations in May. Brown will come back with a revised one. And then in June, we get the official one. And so it's still, it's early, but it's a kind of a good indication of at least where the Department of Finance sees revenue coming in and spending going out. And the Department of Finance has been pretty good, regardless of governor, regardless of party. They know their stuff. What's really concerning here is kind of what's not on the budget. And these are kind of the issues that continue to stick around forever. Brown has been really hesitant to really try to tackle. And I don't really foresee any of his would-be successors really doing it either successfully. So, I'm talking about unfunded liabilities. You have your pension costs. You have your retiree health care benefits. You have the stuff that they borrowed from various special funds from special funds to plug holes in the general fund that still need to be repaid back to those special funds that are incurring interest. Stuff that they owe the federal government, such as the unemployment insurance fund. So you have a lot of these kind of these boxes that don't really show up on the budget. They show up in other places in financial reports in the state government, but not in the budget. But at the end of the day, those things, the bill will come due. And if we're not preparing for it, then we're kind of stuck holding the bag with no money left in it. Right. The rainy day fund is great, but it's not large enough to really help us out in a real bad situation. And this goes to show you, because Brown talked specifically about revenues aren't coming in as expected. We just passed the extension of Prop 30 taxes, tax increases from 2012. It really highlights, once again, the serious, very serious problem California will find itself in once the economy turns downward again, and it will turn downward again. We are too reliant on the top 1% of California's taxpayers. And once things turn a little bit bad, our revenues plummet, and spending doesn't plummet. Mm-hmm. It structurally cannot plummet unless you actually physically cut it. And politicians don't like to cut funding.
Yeah. And I think worrisome is the idea that we are pretty much in a boom economy, and yet one of the problems is that wages have not gone up. Mm. And to go back to Donald Trump, that's that middle class thing of I thought if I worked hard and did my job here, I would have a comfortable living as my parents did. That's not really happening. The other thing I'd say is Governor Brown has made his reputation as sort of a legendary skinflint. He's going to the rainy day fund has we're going to increase the rainy day fund, and now you look at the things that he says now we may not be able to fund public education, health care. These are all hot button issues. The idea of coming back again, we're firing up the people. What? We're not going to help public education. Why wouldn't we do public education? Healthcare is going to be a huge problem. I think there's a method to his madness here to scare us with the deficit, which is legitimate, but also to say, look, we're going to have to make some hard choices. Are you really going to tell us that you're not going to help the people who most desperately need the help in this state?
And I don't think that the deficit includes the amount of money we're spending on the ACA. California gets about $20 billion a year from the federal government for the ACA, and it's got, like, I don't know, 5 million people on getting insurance that way. So if you know, the administration follows through on its promise to basically cut it, and they yank that money away, that's another $20 billion on top of the 1.7. Now, don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, you know, we keep hearing about, you know, repeal and replace, but there's no replacement plan yet. There's been 6 years of talking about repeal and replace. You would have thought that there might be a plan in place by now, but there's not.
You'd think.
And we saw that poll. You saw it, you know, how many people are in favor of Obamacare? What, it was like 37%. And then they turn around and ask him, how about the Affordable Care Act? Oh, I'm in favor of that. That's
70%.
That's much better. So I think, it's become such a political football and such a touchstone that we're ignoring the fact that we have these millions of people that are getting health care for the
first time. Would it be funny if Congress repealed the Obamacare and left the ACA intact? Most people wouldn't know the difference.
Right.
Governor Jerry Brown dedicated this budget to Sutter, his well-loved dog who died last month. He even included a page in it with a paw print and the phrase, quote, save some biscuits for a rainy day, unquote. So we're back to Jerry Brown, as you mentioned, playing the man who's, you know, restraining even his own party, which of course strengthened its hold on the legislature in the recent elections. I'm wondering at what point, so the next gubernatorial election is in 2018, at what point do they stop heeding him because they're going to be voting, if you will, beyond him, you know?
The lame duck.
Well,
I think that happens every term. It's one of those things. He's certainly aware of it. I don't imagine that he's going to run for president. He's how old is he? 77? I think this is probably it for him. I don't think he's particularly concerned about it. He'll try to push what he can through. But we are going to see other people stepping on the stage, elbowing him out of the way if possible. Gavin Newsom, he had the laundry list of people who are going to do it. And good luck to all of them. That's going to be a tough call.
You know, the one thing that may kind of keep Brown's frugalness still in play is John Chung, the current state treasurer who's running for governor. He is a fiscal hawk when it comes to John Chung,
But that's a good question. That's the problem. Exactly.
I mean, he's been in office forever. Again, who?
Right.
So if he is fundraising at just an equal clip as Gavin Newsom is, so he will have the funds to compete. So if he kind of, that fiscal sanity will be a core part of his campaign, that's for sure.
And he's a Democrat?
He's a Democrat, mm-hmm. Yeah. No Republicans have announced yet, except for a former L.A. Rams.
Rosie Greer.
It was interesting you went there because someone, in fact, asked, what are the chances of his successors continuing, you know, the relative budget restraint, or, would Gavin Newsom be more spendthrifty?
Yes. I think that's, we were just talking about that. You know, this is maybe a tangent, but watching Obama's farewell speech, I thought, I wish we'd seen him do that more. You know, we elected him because of that. He was so hopeful. He was so big picture. And then he kind of got involved in the nuts and bolts, and we didn't see it that often. And every time he gave a speech, or Michelle gave a speech, I thought, that's what we had in mind. Now, Gavin Newsom is going to be big picture. Yeah. He's going to have some big ideas. Now, some of them are going to be off the wall, and some of them are going to work, but he's definitely going to be a big picture, inspirational, a man called hope kind of a candidate. And I don't know how that's going to play in this current climate, but that's what we're going to see.
It's, for him, it'll be the double-edged sword because, you know, he's the one that started the same-sex marriage. I was at City Hall Valentine's Day that year. I mean, it was just—it was surreal. But you know, some people are going to love him for that, and the conservative right will hate him for that. And I think that's where you'll find that'll be nationally. That'll be his biggest problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like Carson saying how politicians are risk averse. Gavin Newsom is not risk averse. Right. Okay, he wants to. You know, this is the man who did a 12-hour State of the City. He's got a lot of ideas.
I think the successor is going to be dependent on what the economy is doing. I mean,
meaning good it helps Gavin Newsom or
for whoever it is, whether they can continue, if they want to spend big,
what they do. Okay.
Or if they have to be frugal. You know, if the economy is not doing so hot, then they're going to be forced to cut back. I mean, I talked about Trump and his theatrics. Brown has his own form of theatrics that has been very, very helpful to him, this second iteration of his governor's career, in kind of creating this aura of I'm, you know, the penny pincher, I'm frugal, I'm holding back the legislature. When you actually look at spending increases, it's increased quite a lot during his time in office. It's now exceeds where we were at the peak pre-recession. Mm. The facts really don't line up with kind of this persona that he has built around himself. And part of that may be just kind of the decimation of the Sacramento Press Corps. There just isn't reporting on those sort of things anymore. And also it's just that it's kind of hard to argue with Governor Brown because he comes back at you with something and you're like, well, what does that word mean?
Where did that come from?
And so it's hard, but
on my New Testament and look it up.
Yeah, exactly. we've been spending a lot, and the next governor is going to have to really reconcile that spending with what the revenues look like. And if we don't fix our revenue system in some way, making it less volatile, again, even the smallest little downturn, it's a little blip, can really throw a big hole into the bubble.
You mentioned the governor's theatrics, and I was sitting here thinking, what theatrics? But then I remembered going to Echo Summit and covering him imposing water restrictions on the state at the snow survey when it was a barren field with no snow.
Yeah.
So that,
He's subtle. I mean, he's not bombastic like Donald Trump is. He's subtle about it.
I always think
smart.
Yeah. He came to the editorial board, you know, periodically the politicians in California would come to the editorial board at the Chronicle. And we had at the time a woman who was kind of head of marketing, and she'd never seen him before, and she came to this, and it was probably 25 people. He quoted Latin. He mentioned Greek philosophers I've never heard of. He went off on some tangents, and when he finished, I said, he's the most interesting man in the world. And she said, he really is. But the idea, what I always think as he left, I thought, you know, the idea of some budding politician saying, I'm going to do the Jerry Brown model, what would that be? I mean, holy cow, but he is a fascinating guy. He really is.
One last question before we move off the statewide issue of the budget and such. What impact does the new administration in Washington likely to have on California's infrastructure? I guess what spending we have tied to federal authority and such. Thoughts?
If you believe what the president-elect says, he's going to create all these jobs, I would imagine that would include infrastructure. But at the same time, you might give with one hand and take it away with the other, because a lot of federal funding that California gets, because of the fact that California did not support Trump, I don't know whether or not we're going to find ourselves finding a lot of our federal funding disappearing. I mean, the Sanctuary City money is one I think would be the first to go, but the ACA money, you know, there's a lot of money that's at stake right now, and I'm not sure whether or not the state is going to be safe from vindictiveness.
Would you buy stock in high-speed rail right now?
No.
Yes. That money's gone forever.
Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. That money's gone forever.
Between Los Angeles and San Francisco, there's been a tug of war over the George Lucas Museum. And those of you up here might remember all the hullabaloo about him wanting originally to put it in the Presidio, and then that was rejected. Then he went to Chicago. That was rejected. That fell apart. Came back here. There was a possibility of putting it in Treasure Island, which, if I was reading and following this correctly, was pretty well received in city government. I mean, across the board, I think they kind of thought, okay, less fighting is going to be taking place over there. But this week we learned he had finally settled on Los Angeles as a site of it. And any thoughts on politically, really, kind of impact of this? I mean, it is, as we all know, extremely difficult to develop anything in San Francisco or many large cities. Again, Chicago couldn't do it either. But, were there any failings of leadership, or was this just we didn't do what George Lucas wanted?
Well, we'll get it out of the way. The force was not with us. So we have to, somebody had to say it, so I wanted to go ahead and get it out of the way. San Francisco really wanted this museum. I mean, Ed Lee was on it, and then he pulled in Berkeley and Oakland to make it clear that this is a Bay Area thing. And I think at the core of it, that's the difference. His Treasure Island was potential. If they could get the George Lucas Museum there, they would have a destination that people would go to. And, you know, tourism, $9 billion a year in San Francisco, that's the real engine of San Francisco. Los Angeles, I mean, George Lucas went to USC. He provided the funding for this film school. It's a few hundred yards away from where the museum is going to go. That's a settled place. We've got that. That's in place right now. He had to either buy into the dream, Treasure Island's going to turn into this amazing place in 20 or 30 years, or you could go to Los Angeles and you'd be right there. And the other thing I heard was that his wife, George Lucas's wife, was very interested in making sure the minority community had an opportunity to attend this museum, that they wanted to have accessibility, and that they felt that, you know, Watts is right there, they would have a community. They could walk to the museum. I still think it's very interesting that George Lucas started with what looked like a Roman temple at the Presidio, this crazy with columns and all that stuff, this big square building. And then they said, well, that's horrible. And he said, oh, yeah, you don't like that? How about this? And he creates this whale skeleton or whatever, you know, spaceship or whatever it was, completely different, absolutely a different situation. So I'm not sure. He was kind of all over the map with this. So, and I also think that he was still bitter about how it came down at the Presidio. That had to have figured into it. So
all of his fans were bitter about Jar Jar. Get over it.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if you've seen it, but how many people have seen the collection? Have you seen the collection? There's some stuff in there that's just crazy. There's a whole bunch of Mad Magazine covers. It's about the history of illustration, which makes perfect sense. But, I mean, there's some R. Crumb comic books. There's a lot of Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post covers. And then sort of these old-fashioned Winged Victory, over-the-top romantic. It's not exactly the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well,
how many of you would prefer it be in San Francisco than L.A.?
I would.
Okay.
Now that I'm in L.A.
How many don't care?
Yeah, not that Carson.
Well, what they were saying, we don't have to beat it to death, but, you know, the question was, would people ride a ferry to the Treasure Island to see this? And John King at the Chronicle points out that 1 million people a year visit Alcatraz, and that's only by ferry. And the hope was that people would say, I want to go to Alcatraz, and we would say, well, that's fine. Reservations are booked a month in advance. However, we can give you this ferry boat trip to the George Lucas Museum at Treasure Island, and when you come back, you'll see these phenomenal views of the city. It'll be a great experience. It'll be a great day trip for you. I mean, I think they had a lot of big ideas about that.
Yeah. I would suspect then they're going to still try to find something else to do there. That must have kind of given some fuel to the idea of that can become a destination.
I'm going
to
donate my papers for a library. I think that'll do it.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. I don't know if you have noticed, it's been raining a lot lately. I know, it's like, what is this stuff falling from the sky? It's water, it's rain, it's okay. And in Northern California, now they're saying, you know, in certain parts of it, you can say the drought is technically over. Well, it'll be back at some point. Nonetheless, I wanted to talk a bit about the drought, the politics of the drought, what happens next. Southern California, where Carson now lives, is not technically out of the drought. Bob, you've been reporting on it, and he was playing some recordings of the storm runoff for me earlier. What have you been seeing? What do you think is going to happen now?
Well, the federal government declared the drought over in California, Northern California, north of Interstate 80, which I can't quite understand where that is, because 80 runs east and west. I guess that's Sacramento, those areas up there. But that was the federal government. Local water officials are saying, whoa, hey, hold on a second. We still have to, we can't just go willy-nilly and start using water again. We have to still conserve. It's clear that the snowpack is, you know, humongous. If you look at the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, it's the highest it's been. Water storage is extremely high. I live out in East Contra Costa County in Los Vaqueros Reservoir. And we marched, we did a hike there about a year ago, and you could actually see, like, it looked like beaches because the water was down so far down below the rocks. I went up there again yesterday, and all you could see is rocks. The water has come up so much. So I do believe that we're in a much better situation now, but, you know, we spent so much time taking water out of the ground, especially the farmers, that water needs to, we need to figure out a way to replenish that. I don't know how you replenish groundwater aside from just having the rain seep down. But we're still in a situation, I mean, you know, we're at my house, you know, we actually still use buckets to get the water hot in the bathroom and then use that water when we flush the toilet, you know, to save water. Because why just have that water run down to the drain? So I think we're better. State officials don't want to say that we're out of the drought yet because, you know, if we're out of the drought, people are going to use more water, you know.
Carson, I mean, I would assume the it was difficult enough to get, you know, people to conserve water when we were in, you know, year four of this horrible drought. I think the pressure that is going to be pretty strong from folks saying, what do you mean drought? You know, I've got my backyard's flooded.
I shudder every time I see rain, actually, because especially coming out of a drought, because it makes everyone think automatically, well, okay, we're done. We're good. Yeah. We're in the clear. When we are, yes, it's better than it was, you know, this date last year, this date 2 years ago. But the state is still in a serious issue that will take years of this type
storms
of
like this, yeah.
Weather we're seeing to really get us back to where we were 5, 6, 7 years ago. The northern part of California now is completely drought-free, according to the drought monitor. Unfortunately for California, not many people live there. when you're talking about population, still about 50% of the population is in extreme or exceptional drought conditions. That's the top two categories of drought conditions that the entire state was in at one point, a few months to a year ago. That's concentrated down toward the central coast, the southern central valley, and of course then the southern coast, LA County, of obviously being the biggest piece of the puzzle there. Snowpack is great now after this. If you see photos, you're like, yeah, awesome. Go to Tahoe. Let's get some skiing in finally. And we are. I mean, we're at 160% of the
normal
average normal for the state.
Yeah.
But we're still only at 70% of the normal as of April 1st. And that's the key number. That's the key date. April 1st is when our water really starts to then trickle down the mountains into our reservoirs, into the groundwater aquifers, so that we are prepared for the rest of the year for our water usages, because our system is really designed around snowmelt. All this rain we see here, it's great, theoretically, for your backyards, but it's rushing right into the Pacific Ocean. It's not being really captured.
So this is theoretical rain?
It's theoretical rain, oh. Yeah. For consumption uses.
It seems like, it does seem like, though, that the elephant in the room or the hippopotamus in the room or whatever it is the Central Valley, which is using an enormous amount of water. And it's been very hard to get our arms around that. And I read, I think it was in the New Yorker, there was a story, we're talking about the groundwater and the deeper and deeper wells that people are drilling. And there was a story about a small family-owned almond orchard. They had a farm. And they had a farmhouse on the actual property, and the wife was doing the dishes at the sink. And out of her window, she could look across and see that this great big conglomerate had built this enormous agricultural area. And they had a huge drilling operation, drill down to groundwater. And they knew they were drilling, but they hadn't actually activated it. And as she was doing the dishes, they turned it on, and her faucet went dry at that moment. And the amount of water that they're using and the amount of water they need to use to keep this agricultural business going is incredible.
The economics of the Central Valley are becoming a problem for water usage, because the Central Valley has been using the groundwater aquifer because they haven't been getting state surface water transfers because of the drought. Because our reservoirs have really been depleted. And so they've been relying on drilling. Well, as you start to drill, you start to use that water, you have to drill deeper. It's expensive to drill deeper. So then you need to change your crops into something that's going to yield more revenue for your farm, which typically require more water. So then you need to be drilling deeper to get more water, but then you need to add more of those types of crops into the mix. So you get stuck into, for lack of a better word, a kind of a water death spiral situation. And the groundwater aquifer is falling. You can actually see the difference in the land. I mean, you can look at the telephone poles and kind of see where the land once was and where it is now. And that takes a long, aquifers take a long time to replenish. Very long time. And how do you replenish them? You flood the land. You have to let the water seep back down into the ground. So that takes a long time to get it back up to where you were at the beginning of a drought season.
And add to that, in the Central Valley, people can't afford to live here in the Bay Area. You build more homes out there in the Central Valley, you know, and that puts more pressure on your water system.
The moral of the story here is Jerry Brown in Sacramento let a good crisis go to waste at the end of the day for the political and water reforms that we really needed.
You were talking about the water along the coast basically going right into the ocean. Is there a feasible way of capturing some of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of options out there. It's whether you have the political will and then the funds to be able to handle it. A, our entire system needs to be redesigned. It was designed for a climate that really no longer exists, nor probably will exist into the future. We need to be capturing more rainfall. We need to be utilizing more other resources, you know, desalination along the coast, desalination in the Central Valley to clean wastewater in the Central Valley to be reused for crops, capturing rain, but then also just making the water markets actually work in the state. Talk to someone who's tried to actually trade water within the state of California, and they'll just laugh at you because it's impossible. It's functionally impossible because of the regulations, because of the uncertainty around the entitlements for water rights, whether if they trade them, will that person ever get them back? So there's a lot of complexities there that really need to happen, that this type of a drought created the massive stakeholder interests, whether it's the environmentalists, the farmers, the municipal users, et cetera, that Jerry Brown, who had a substantial political capital, could have gotten them all to the table and said, okay, now's the time we have to do this. And it's possible. Australia did it in the early 2000s.
Yeah. Speaking of desalinization, when I was in the Navy, I was down in Guantanamo Bay. We got all of our water from the desal plants. We had two big boilers. And when one of the boilers would go down, we'd go on water hours. So desal does work. It is expensive.
It is.
Cabo San Lucas in Mexico, that's where they get their water. Yeah. They do desal plants. Yeah, so it is possible. Maybe we could take some of that money we're going to spend on a wall and build some desal plants.
Again, none of these things are silver bullets. I mean, you can't fix the problem with just by building a few desal plants along the coast. And there are trade-offs, obviously, to that that need to be considered. But it needs to be a comprehensive solution. It needs to be a systemic reform of the entire way we handle water in the state of California. Because we're dealing with water in the state of California the same as the Gold Rush era. I mean, that's where the foundations of our water system were created. We're a vastly different state,
we need
if you
more
haven't noticed.
Yeah, right.
We need more reservoirs. We need a way to capture. Yeah. I mean, just watching all of the water up in Napa, I was driving to Santa Elena, water from the vineyards was washing over onto Highway 29. They had to close down the highway. And all that water goes into the storm drains and ends up, you know, in the river or out in the ocean, and we don't have enough reservoirs or any place to put it. Mm-hmm. You know, for them, we ought to have a system where we can actually save all that water that's coming out now, that's coming down from the sky and draining into the reservoirs in the delta. If we had that, we wouldn't probably have water problems. But that takes, a major will to do that. I mentioned I live out in Contra Costa, and the Los Vaqueros Reservoir, they started building that before I moved out there. But now it holds like 100 million acre feet of water, you know, which is not even enough for the Bay Area for a year.
Okay. One last question before we go to the news quiz. One last question for the panel, that is. What did you think of Meryl Streep's speech at the Golden Globes? She was awarded the Cecil B. DeMille Award and used that as an opportunity to attack President Trump.
Well,
Bob?
She is a member of SAG-AFTRA, which is the performers union, and as am I. I'm on the national board. I will give her great props for her acting career. But I don't put a whole lot of, I don't care a lot about what Hollywood people say about anything because they're actors. On the other hand, we've always wanted our celebrities to take stances on issues of importance throughout the country. You know, I don't necessarily agree with, you know, going after the president-elect, but, I mean, she was speaking from the heart, and she wasn't lying. It wasn't fake news. So I have no problem with what she did.
I think we applaud her and move on. That was fine, and I'm glad she said it, but it didn't affect any change, and it probably won't. But it's there's a part of it's kind of easy to do that, you know, to be Meryl Streep and get up and say this is terrible. And she called out some very specific things, which were terrible. I think they were terrible. But at the end of the day, we're going to have some substantial progress in some manner. She called attention to it. That's fine. But now let's see something really happen.
Okay, Carson, any thoughts?
The only thing I would add is, you know, to the president-elect's opponents moving forward, they're going to have to be very careful in who the messengers are and how they deliver that message. For someone who was elected on the message he was elected on and by the people he was elected by, a Hollywood actress sitting in a room full of Hollywood actors and producers in Hollywood with gowns, everything.
Preaching to the choir.
That's... it's not going to help them out, to say the least. So, while the message may have been accurate, it probably fell on a lot of deaf ears for the people that they need to be trying to attract to affect the change in the next election, whether that's the midterms or in 2020.
And the media reaction was just horrible.
Yeah.
It wasn't a lead story to me.
Yeah.
It shouldn't have been a lead story, but it was.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the reaction the next morning.
The coverage of it.
The tweet reaction, yeah.
Well, before we send you out back into the chilly winter night, let's end with our news quiz. What I'm going to do, for those of you who have not done this before, I'm going to read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you and shout it out. If you win, then Colette will give you a bag of chocolate to keep you warm on these cold winter nights. And also, if you win, then maybe let others win the other questions. So, first question: what athletic team is national? Is break not a national team? What athletic team in this country is breaking tradition by visiting the White House this month? I saw your hand right away.
Chicago Cubs.
The world champion, the World Series champions, usually visit the following summer when they're in the D.C. area. They wanted to visit while Barack Obama was still in office.
He's from Chicago, if that kind of makes sense. Kind of makes sense.
Well, he's a White Sox fan, though, so.
He's
got good taste, then. Okay, following the Berlin Christmas market killings, you saw that, who will the country make wear ankle monitors? Did you see the story? They're going to put ankle monitors on somebody. Wayne Beck? Close, but it's even more specific. Anyone else want to take a guess? No, it's specifically suspected jihadis. So there are obviously other folks they're deporting who aren't that. So let's just move on to Poland's foreign minister was lampooned on Twitter this week after he did what?
This is a tough news.
Really? I know.
I have to say.
No one wants to guess? Okay. Yeah, you wouldn't have guessed this unless you saw the story.
Did he call Meryl Streep overrated as an actress?
He did. Isn't that amazing? No, he invented a country that he claimed to have visited or to met while pursuing a seat on the Security Council. Okay. Here's one. Chelsea Manning is reportedly on President Obama's shortlist for what, sir? Right, commutation of her sentence. Next question. Following his conviction for massacring members of a black church in South Carolina, what was Dylann Roof's sentence? Death. Way in the back.
Death penalty.
Death penalty, that's correct. See, they're not all impossible questions.
Okay. All right.
The EPA is accusing a major car company of using technology that lets their diesel vehicles exceed the limits. Sir, in I guess the fourth row there, I saw your hand. Fiat Chrysler, yes. They said VW had so much fun doing it, we'll do it too. What tech company says it will create 100,000 jobs in the United States over the next 18 months? Way in back, I'm sorry, I saw your hand first. I'm sorry?
Amazon,
that's right. Okay, we've got a few more. Los Angeles will now have two NFL teams. As what team goes to join the Rams? Ma'am, I saw your hand pop right up. The Chargers, that's correct.
Not the Raiders.
What European company will pay $4.2 billion to settle charges in the United States? Sir, your hand?
Volkswagen,
right. The other emissions cheater. Librarians in Sorrento, Florida, were disciplined for a scheme to protect some books. What did they do? Sir?
They claimed people were checking out.
Right, they actually made up people to check out books that they would have had to get rid of otherwise for non-use. What? Those librarians are my heroes. I think that's great. France's far light. Okay, let's just start the program over. Welcome to Week to Week. France's far right leader, Marine Le Pen, was spotted where in New York today? Way in back?
Trump Tower,
that is correct. And Colette, do we have one more left after this?
Yes, one more.
Good, I can count. I can't always, so that's good. What interrupted a meeting of the Oakland City Council this past Tuesday? Did anyone see this? It's Oakland. It could have been Chicago.
Gunfire.
No. Do not give him chocolate. There was gunfire right outside. Someone was shot. Okay. Let's go with another one quickly. Asylum seekers. The number of asylum seekers dropped by 70% last year in what country? Way in back, sir?
Germany,
that is correct. Well, we will have more news quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to talk about right after the inauguration when we're back in 2 weeks on Monday, January 30th, right here in the great city of San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz most weeks on Huffington Post. Thanks to our great panel today, Bob Butler, Chuck Nevius, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you for coming out, everyone watching us online and on TV. Have a great week.